My name is Frank Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sure glad to be here tonight, and I would like to, first of all, thank the committee for inviting my wife and I here to the roundup and asking me to participate at this opening meeting. I'm honored by that, and I'm very grateful. And it's just good to be here, and it's just good to be sober. And I've had a good time, and you can look around if you just got here. And I'll tell you this, the committee sure knows how to pave the way and landscape the road to happy destiny, don't they? Woo! This place is hot. I love it. I'll tell you, my digs upstairs, my little hooch that I'm staying in ain't too bad either. But it's sure good to be here, and I've enjoyed the activities so far, and I've enjoyed the fellowship, and I've enjoyed the emotions and feelings that go along with events like this in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it doesn't get any purer than this than when we start filling this room up with people that are trying to stay sober and families that are pulling themselves back together. And we're here together this weekend, and we're going to get it done. And we're going to leave here happy, joyous, and free one more time. And I'm just happy to be a part of that. I enjoyed the Al-Anon speaker this afternoon, Yvonne. But she talked about being around one day and being disturbed by the fact she had to spend a couple hours with Bozettes and Bimbos. I spent a lot of time with them, and I kind of thought I had scored. I liked it. I wish some of you ladies wouldn't laugh, though, because it may have been with you. No, there are some lovely ladies here, and I wish they hadn't have paraded those hostesses up in front of me before this meeting started. It got me thrown completely off track of why I'm here and almost made me forget I had my wife with me. They are some foxes. We have some lovely ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous. One thing you're not going to hear tonight, and I got to tell you this about me. I don't go to any meetings but Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I'm not an adult child of an alcoholic. I'm not codependent. I don't come from a dysfunctional family. I haven't been through a treatment center for the affected member family syndrome yet. I don't go to Sex Anonymous, Smokers Anonymous, or Al-Anon. I go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because I'm a drunk. And that's all that I do. The other thing that I have is I don't have anybody to blame this on. I'm an alcoholic, and I have no reason to be here tonight. I mean, look at me. I don't even look like an alcoholic. A lot of you people do. But I come from a normal home. I have a loving mother and father that cared for me and provided for me and my two brothers. I was born in Danville, Illinois. And if I could have wrote out a script for my childhood, it couldn't have been any better than it was. It was absolutely phenomenal. My mother and father this year will be married 50 years to each other. My father worked the same job for over 40 years, and he provided a good home. And I don't understand those two things, long-term job and long-term marriage. And I don't know where this come from, except I drank badly. And then when I didn't drink, I felt badly, and so I drank. And when I drank, I then acted badly again, and the guilt and those feelings wove me over, and I had to drink to cope with them, and I don't know where that come from. And I was blessed with an amount of athletic ability when I was growing up. And I played ball, and I had a lot of fun, and I didn't have a lot of problems growing up. I had a good home, and I found out since I got sober some things that I had going on that I didn't know about that confused me, and some emotions and feelings I dealt with that I didn't know how to deal with, so I stuffed them. But I started playing doctor at the early age of 6 or 7 with a little girl next door, and I liked playing doctor with her. But I knew it was wrong because I grew up in a good home, and I knew about right from wrong. But, you know, I kept doing it because it felt good. And I stuffed those feelings down. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous ain't changed that. It still feels good, and I still do it. I went with my wife. But, and the other problem I had growing up is I was a perfectionist. And everything had to be just perfect, and my parents didn't put those demands on me. But, you know, I could spot dust across the carpet at 50 feet. And my mom and dad would leave to go to the store, and I'd wax the floors, or I'd polish the furniture, or I'd wash the windows and stuff, or clean out the storm drain so I'd feel part of that family. Because I never quite felt like I fit in there, and I don't know where that feeling come from. And, you know, if you're going to start playing doctor at an early age, you got nothing to offer. So I started ironing my underwear. And I started ironing the sheets that I slept on. And I don't know where that come from, and I have a problem with perfectionism today, and I work on it because I know it's a character defect. And I could spot dust on the carpet at home, and I tell my wife about it. And she come up with the brilliant question of why are you always looking down? She's in Al-Anon. And you know, I don't know why I keep looking down, and so I did, and I started looking up, and I started pointing out the cobwebs in the corners. It just makes her crazy. But that's how I grew up, and the other thing growing up is I wanted to be a part of you guys. You know, I wanted to be a part of that crowd, that clique, those guys that fit together, and they hung together, and they talked to each other, and they did things together, and I wanted to be a part of that. And I never did feel a part of it, but I was. When I got sober, I looked back and seen that. I was a big part of it. Because I was a jock and I played ball and I played football, basketball and run track and I did that through grade school and into high school. But I wanted to fit in with you guys and I didn't feel like I could because you scared me and I had these secrets. I was doing those things with that little girl and something that just slipped my mind like it usually does. I forgot to tell you I'm a liar and a cheat and a thief. And I grew up stealing and lying and cheating and I don't know where that come from. I didn't learn that at home. But you know, I couldn't tell you guys that because I wanted to fit in with you. And when you scared me, what would happen is I had to push you out of my face. You scared me so bad I had to become violent. And you know, down on Main Street when I was growing up, I grew up during a macho era in the 60s, and John Wayne and Wild Bill Hickok and those guys were big, and I wanted to be like those guys. And down on Main Street, the guys that I really wanted to fit in with hung out, and these guys wore black leather jackets that had zippers and doodads all over them, and they wore ducktail haircuts, and they had long sideburns and engineer boots, and I wanted to fit in with those guys. But you see, those guys down there were tough. And some of them carried guns, and some of them carried switchblade knives. And they scared me and intimidated me, and I didn't want to show that fear. You see, I was even afraid of the dark growing up, and I couldn't tell anybody that. That was a secret that I carried for a long time. I didn't let that out until I got here with you people, and I found out that that was just fear. And the biggest thing to fear was just fear. And I didn't know that. But you know, these guys scared me, and so I had to start fighting. And look at me. I'm too light to fight and too thin to win. So I had to develop a technique of ambush. And I did that. And I started hitting guys with bricks and sticks and clubs so I could win the fight because I didn't like pain. And I got to tell you that the bigger you get, the fights you get into get worse and you start hurting people. And then I'd go back to school and I'd be stealing and I'd be doing everything I was supposed to do with the girls and playing ball, but I wasn't learning anything and I was ashamed of that. And, you know, I kept fighting and getting in trouble and I started hurting these guys. And I'd go home at night and I'd feel guilty about hitting somebody in the face with a brick or something. And that feeling would just overwhelm me, and I had that shame, and I'd have to push those feelings down inside me. And, you know, I wasn't even drinking yet, and I had all these feelings and emotions I didn't know how to deal with. And what happened was, is one night I was at a party, and I had a girlfriend. I always had a girlfriend. And she brought me over a 16-ounce tea glass full of sloe gin and 7-Up. And I hadn't drank before, and I was a senior in high school. And, you know, I took a sip of that stuff, and it was hot like it is here today. And it tasted like strawberry Kool-Aid, and I like that. And I chug-lugged that glass of sloe gin and 7-Up down. Now, I got to tell you, if you're new, nothing happened. I didn't put on a trench coat and get me a bottle of wine and put it in a paper bag and go out and hang out on Skid Row. That didn't happen. I didn't grow hair on the palms of my hand and turn into a werewolf. None of those things happened. What happened was I bossed her around, and I was going to do that to a woman for a long time after that until I got here with you and Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, go get me another one, and she did. She brought me another 16-ounce tea glass of sloe gin and 7-Up, and I chug-lugged that, and nothing happened. I didn't cross some invisible line on the floor. I didn't get all crazy. I didn't even get 6'4", and my pimples didn't fall off. But you know what happened is I drank a gallon of that stuff in about 30 minutes, and I waited for about 25 minutes, and I was cool. And something did happen then, and I found out where sloe gin got its name, because I got drunk as hell. And, you know, I went into a blackout, and what happened was is I got taken home by some friends of mine. And that morning I woke up, and I was sicker than a dog, and I was vomiting up all this red stuff. And my mom and dad were yelling at me because they didn't want their son drinking and acting like this because I had scholarship offers to play ball. And they thought that was bad, and I was sick, and my head was throbbing and pounding, and my stomach was upset, and I was just crazy. And I didn't know what the hell my problem was. And what happened was I missed 3 days of school with that hangover. And you know, when I went back to school, those guys come up to me. And I thought all of those guys experienced the same thing that I did that night. You see, I didn't remember anything that had happened, and those guys come up and they told me what happened. They told me that I was out there dancing and I was funny, and I liked that, man. I liked that recognition. I liked that feeling a part of that they made me feel. And they told me that this guy lipped off, and I hit him in the face, and he went through a screen door. And they told me that I was out there doing those things, and I liked that. But you know, I couldn't remember any of those things. And you know, I didn't know until I got here with you people what a blackout was. Now, I don't know if you people ever had a blackout. I don't know how you drank. But I got to tell you this, for me, when I got here, I found out that a blackout was when I consumed amounts of alcohol, I would continue to function, and I'd continue to do the things that I was doing. But the next morning when I got up, I couldn't remember what I'd done. Any of you ever had that experience? You know, I didn't know that that was something here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I found out that when Frank Jones drank an amount of alcohol, he would go into a blackout, and that's what it was, and that everybody didn't have those. But that happened to me that night. But I like that recognition, and I did learn something else that night, too. You know what? From that day, back there in the early 60s, in 1961, to this day, July 14th, 1989, I have never had another glass of 7-Up. I don't drink that stuff. It made me crazy and made me forget about that night. And I don't drink 7-Up. I'm a Pepsiologist now. And I didn't turn into a blazing alcoholic, and I didn't go crazy drinking, but what I did do is I continued to fight and be macho, and what happened was, is it come time to make a decision to go to college and pick a scholarship, because I was playing football and basketball, and what happened is I hadn't learned anything, and I couldn't tell anybody. I didn't know what the word vocation meant, and I was ashamed of that. And so I did what macho tough guys that are fighting and stealing and raising hell do. I quit high school, and I joined the Marine Corps 2 weeks before graduation. Now, joining the Marine Corps is macho. And you know, I was a big deal, and my parents wasn't going to sign for me, and I brought those papers home from the recruiter, and my dad whipped his name on those papers so quick I couldn't believe it. I went into shock, and I found myself on a train going up to Chicago, and I am sitting right next to my idol. This guy's got a greasy ducktail haircut and long sideburns and a leather jacket on, and I wanted to be like that guy looked. He looked cool, and he looked slick, and he was macho, and that's what I wanted to be. And he's drinking this stuff out of a little brown bottle, and he pokes me, and he says, "You want a drink of this, man?" And what am I going to tell this guy? "No, no thanks, man. I go into a blackout when I drink that stuff." I couldn't tell him that, and I told him sure, because I wanted to fit in with him, and I wanted him to like me. And, you know, I didn't drink it. I drank it the same way I did that slow gin and 7-Up. I chug-a-lugged about 4 or 5 big mouthfuls. And I don't know what you did when you drank whiskey when you were 17, but I can tell you what I did. I threw that crap right back up, and my eyes started watering. I had snot running out of my nose, and I didn't look macho. And I was embarrassed and ashamed, and I wiped off my face, and I handed him that whiskey back, and I said, "That sure was good." You know, I just wanted him to like me. I just wanted to feel a part of that guy, and that's the only way I knew how to do it, was to fake it till I make it. And I've also learned that that's how I can do it here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can just keep taking the actions until I make it, you know, and it just works a little bit at a time. But back then, I didn't care about that, you see. And he asked me if I wanted another drink, and I said no. I'm not a fool. I didn't want to look bad. And I got sworn in, and I found myself on a flight out here, and I pulled up in front of Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego, and I was on that bus, and I was slicking my leather jacket, my white crew neck, and my flat top, and I knew I was macho because I was with all you older guys. You were all 19, 20-year-old. And this guy got on that bus that had on a funny round hat and a shaved head. And I don't know how he picked me out. But he picked me out, and he snatched me up by my leather jacket, and he threw me off that bus and called me dirty names that you folks here in AA don't even use. And I was embarrassed and ashamed. And that's how I went through boot camp, full of fear and full of anxiety and full of homesickness and loneliness, because I had that loneliness that I wanted to fit in, and I couldn't. You know, I got through boot camp, and I found myself, after a period of time, going through the Panama Canal in 1962, and I'm going to go kill Cubans. That's macho. But you know, on that ship, I'm full of fear and scared, and I don't know how to deal with that fear. So I'm doing what I've seen John Wayne do. I'm sharpening my bayonet. I'm going to win the Medal of Honor, you know. But you know, I got this fear, and I got these hot rocks in my stomach, and some of my buddies broke in the narcotics locker on that ship, and they brought me down a morphine syringe. And I took that plastic cap off, and I put that needle in my leg, and I squeezed that juice out. And you know what? That fear went away. And I went up on the deck of the ship that night, and I laid out there all night, and I looked at those stars. And I wasn't afraid no more. And if you'd have walked up to me that night and said, "Hey, Jones, you know why you're not afraid?" I said, "Yeah, I know why, man. I know why. Because I grew up all of a sudden. I matured, okay? You know, I didn't know then what I know tonight, that when I ingest some type of narcotic into my system, that it takes that fear away and it rips that craziness out of me and it calms my head down and tells me okay and it allows me to act the way I think I should act to be cool. And I didn't know that narcotics did that for me. I didn't know that until I got here with you. I got to tell you, I didn't use any more narcotics either. So you're not going to hear anything more about that. You see, anybody can become a dope fiend. All you got to do is stick a needle in your arm and squeeze the juice in there. You'll become addicted to it. Snort cocaine, you're going to become addicted to it. There ain't no social coke users. But if you're going to be an alcoholic and be here with us tonight at this roundup, you got to do some things. You've got to be able to drink this whiskey and all this booze. You got to be able to stand around and wet your pants. You got to be able to crap your pants. You got to be able to sleep in bushes and look bad and lose jobs and abuse your families. And you got to do it year after year for a lot of years to get here. You can't be a quitter, for Christ's sakes. You got to hang in. And that's how we got here tonight. And that's what we did. So you see, I'm just an alcoholic. I'm just a drunk. And that's what happened. And I didn't get to kill any Cubans, and I was disappointed. And we come back through the Panama Canal, and I ended up in Okinawa. And in Okinawa, there wasn't no drinking age. And all you older guys come up to me and said, "Hey, let's go get a drink, Frank. Let's go get drunk." And I said, "Let's go." You know, I didn't say, "Let's go out and have a highball, and then I'll write letters home to Mom and Dad." I didn't say that. I said, "Let's go get drunk," and we set out to do that. And that night, I was with the boys, and that's what I wanted. And we bought a Typhoon Fifth of sake. It cost us 75 cents back then. It was rap gut stuff, I'll tell you. About 140 proof, and these guys started passing that bottle around, and they passed it to me, and I drank it like I did Slow Gin and 7-Up. I chug-a-lugged it, and I got to tell you what happened. I threw that crap back up, come out my nose, and my eyes watered, snot running down my face again, and I'm wiping it off, trying to be macho, and these guys are laughing and punching each other. And I'm feeling inadequate and like a wimp, and I don't want to be any wimp. I want to be macho, for Christ's sakes, because that's macho is what's happening. And I felt like a wussy, and I didn't like it. And they kept passing it around, and I kept drinking some and throwing it up and drinking it and throwing it up, and I'm splashing this stuff all over their shoes. Man, I'm wasting it. And I couldn't believe it, and I was embarrassed and full of shame. And, you know, I finally drank enough of that stuff, something happened. I drank enough of that sake down, and I looked at those five or six guys I was standing with, and I realized something. A revelation come to me. I realized that those five or six guys were punks, and I didn't need them. And a 17-year-old Frank Jones set out on his own to become the ugly American over there, and I succeeded at that. And what happened was I became a bar drinker, and I went out there that night in the Ville, and I spent my whole money on wine, women, and song. And after that night, I didn't put any more money in the jukebox. I thought dancing was a waste of energy and a waste of motion. And I got drunk, and I got in a fight, and I hit a guy in the face with a pool cue, because that's what Marines do. They fight, and they're macho. And I took this little Nissan home, and her and I did what we had to do, and I gave her some money, and she went to clean up, and when she did, I stole my money back and set her hooch on fire. I thought that was macho. And, you know, I didn't remember any of that. And the next morning when I got up, I had a terrible hangover, and I was vomiting and throwing up and crazy. And the guys come up, and they started slapping me on the back and laughing and telling me what I'd done, and I felt that pride. Because, you see, before they started talking to me, I felt shame. I felt shame, and I felt like I had degraded the family name, and I had anxiety and guilt and remorse and those feelings I couldn't deal with. And, you know, I had that headache, and I was vomiting in the head and everything, and I was throwing up and crazy, and I found out a secret that morning. I found out that if I went to my wall locker and I got a bottle of Akadama wine out, and I drank a little bit of that wine down and drank some water, that my headache went away. And that grinding and guilt and all those feelings I had in my gut and in my head went away. And my stomach settled down, and I became a morning drinker and a daily drinker at the age of 17. And I proceeded to do a lot of things over there that I'm ashamed of, and I did a lot of fighting and carrying on. And, you know, I ran out of money one day over there. And, you know, in the Marine Corps, when you fight and carry on and get in trouble, they have court-martials and office hours, and I started getting those. And I'd make rank, and I'd lose it, and I'd make rank, and I'd lose it. And if you'd have walked up and said, "Hey, Frank, you know why you keep getting busted, man? It's because of the booze, man. You're fighting and raising hell, and you're AWOL." And I'd have told you to get out of my face. Booze ain't got nothing to do with it. Booze ain't got anything to do with my problem. It's that company gunny. It's the company commander. It's those little people over there, man, that are ripping me off. And the women are drinking watered-down drinks. And those other guys in that other unit, they ask for it, and I give it to them. You see, I could rationalize and justify all my actions. It was never the alcohol until I got here with you. I never looked at me as being the problem. I could always point my finger at you, and I did it. And I damn near rationalized and justified myself right into death and into insanity, because I could always put the blame on somebody else for my actions. And I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm responsible for my actions, that I am my biggest problem. And to deal with my problem, I've got to come here to you people and learn to work these 12 steps. And I've got to become an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous and do the things that the rest of you are doing that make you successful. And I didn't know that then, because I was a blamer and a finger pointer. And what happened was, I ran out of money over one day, and I was starting to have some withdrawals, and I was starting to get the shakes, and I was starting to get crazy. And so we was going to rob this cab driver, and we pulled him over. And when we did, I grabbed a hold of him, I jerked him out of that cab, and I held his head down the pavement. I beat his face in with a rock that day. And Marine Corps really frowns on that. And I ended up getting a general court martial. And my father had to fly to Okinawa, and he had to pay for that man's reconstructive surgery, and he had to pay for his medical bills and his retirement. And the whole time I kept begging him, "Don't throw me out of the Marine Corps. It's the only thing I know how to do." And I didn't want to disgrace my family, and I just begged him not to throw me out. And at my court martial, If you'd have told me that alcohol played a part in that, I'd have told you you're crazy. Alcohol doesn't have anything to do with that. Those people are overcharging me every time they take me somewhere, and I was just getting back what was mine. You see, my intentions were always that way, and my actions weren't. My actions were always substandard. And what happened was I didn't get discharged. I got sentenced to 2 years confinement at hard labor and back to duty for assault with intent to commit murder. And if you've been in the military, you know that can't happen. And what happened was they had to discharge me, and by the time the paperwork was processed, I had spent a year locked up. And when I got out of there, I was here, and I drank in the bars that way, and I was at Camp Pendleton, and I got crazy there, and what happened is I met a woman, and I married her. And, you know, I started abusing that woman, and I drank at home, and she started chipping her teeth at me and running her mouth, and I didn't want to hear that crap from her. You see, I didn't know then what I know now. You see, I thought I had to tell her how to act and how to dress and what to do and how to keep the house and how to treat me and how to do the things for me that I wanted her to do. I didn't know until I got a sponsor and I got here with you and I watched you with your wives and husbands and girlfriends and everything, that she was an individual and she was a person and she had the right to be who she wanted to be and wear what she wanted to wear. But when she did those things when I was drinking, I got crazy and I abused her, and I'm not proud of that. And I continued to fight and be a crazy here, and I started carrying a gun into the bars. And then we had a little daughter, and I started abusing that family, and I was a raving maniac at home. And I'd get crazy, and I'd yell and scream at them and put demands on them, and kids ain't supposed to cry. And I didn't know that until I got here, that kids can make messes, and kids can do those things, and they can cry, and they can leave toys out. And you see, I wasn't allowing that little child to be a child, and I was a maniac at home. And then I felt guilty, and then I'd have to go out and drink to take the guilt away and those feelings. And then when I drank, I'd meet her in the bar, and I'd have to validate myself with another woman. And then somebody'd come up and say something to me, and I'd have to break his face. And then those feelings again, and I'd have to drink to take those feelings away. And that's the way it went for me. And finally, I got called into the CO's office one day, and he says that I was macho and tough. And what he did was he issued me a rifle with a telescope on it and some live ammunition. And I got orders to a little place across the ocean called Vietnam. And I got to tell you this before I even get started on it. Vietnam ain't my problem. Never has been. Vietnam is not my problem. I was an alcoholic long before I went over there. I was a morning drinker and a daily drinker from the age of 17, and I didn't go over there until I was 22. And I was already having hallucinations and urinating blood by the time I went over there. So I don't blame it on that, and I don't hang my hat on it, and I have no problems with it today, thanks to my sponsor and a room full of people like you and a lot of veterans that I talk to and a lot of you people that just tell me it's just emotions. But I got to tell you, when I landed over in Da Nang, I was terrified. Now, I'm going into combat with these Marines, and I can't look over at them and tell them how terrified I am. I can't tell them that my guts are in knots and I'm so full of fear that I can hardly move. You can't do that because I had to be macho and I had to suck it up and stick my chin out. And what I did is I found out a secret over there. You know, I found out that if I put 151 proof rum in my canteens, that stuff would make me invisible and bulletproof. And I loved it. And what I did was I drank it, took the fear away, and what happened was is every time I'd go out on patrols or operations, you see, I was up on the DMZ, and I was a sniper, and I worked with recon a lot. And a lot of the things I'd done, I'm ashamed of, and you've read about them in Time Magazine and Newsweek. But what happened when we'd come back in our harbor site, I'd have to drink whiskey to take that madness out of my gut and to shut my head off because I thought I was going to go crazy. You see, I thought I was going to flip out, and I didn't want anybody to know that I felt bad about the things I was doing. And I did all the things that you see and hear and read about, and I am not proud of that, but that's what I did. And during March of 1968, I finally got blown up during a siege at Khe Sanh, and I was back here in the States, and what happened was is while I was on Hill 881 over there, my wife had a son born to us. And I come back no way, no shape, no maturity at all to be a husband and a father. What I came back was an angry, hateful, unfeeling human being that had no right to be around decent people and children. And I abused that family, and one day, about the third day back, she was yelling and screaming at me and chipping her teeth at me about drinking, and those kids were crying, and I was yelling, and I was a maniac, and I got to tell you what happened. As I told her, if she didn't shut up, I'd kill her. And you know, that woman didn't believe me that day. And I walked into the closet in that bedroom, and I got a gun off the closet shelf, and I walked back out there in the living room. And I'm trying to get the safety off that gun, and I got a little girl crying, telling me, don't shoot my mommy. And I got a little boy that was crying, trying to stand up, holding on to my trouser leg. And I got a wife that's standing there chipping her teeth at me, and you know the kind. Al-Anon, like that lady that talked today. Oh, you did great, Yvonne. But she was chipping her teeth at me, and she wouldn't shut up. And I got to tell you, there was a God in that house that day, and I hadn't believed in God for a long time. You see, by now I'd already broke all 10 of the commandments. By now I knew if there was a God that I was screwed, and I knew where I was going. So I had quit believing in God, and I kept drinking that whiskey, and I tried to get the safety off that gun. But there was a God in that house that day looking out after a drunk named Frank Jones and those children and that wife, because the safety wouldn't come off. And what happened was I pushed a spring, and that spring came out the back, and I pushed that spring back in, and that gun went off. And that bullet went through my hand down between my legs where those kids were standing. And that bullet didn't hit either one of them that day. And you know, I'm lucky for that. And so are those kids, because I love those kids today. But there was a God in that house that was protecting them and me, and I'm a grateful man today for that. You see, I didn't get to kill that woman that day, and there ain't no doubt in my mind I would have. But you see, you know what happened shortly after that? You're not going to believe this. That woman divorced me. I can't believe that. No, don't clap. It ain't like I fired a whole clip or nothing. I fired one shot. That's all. I fired one shot and shot myself, for Christ's sakes, and you're clapping. She was a wimp. And she took those kids and run off with a state policeman from Indiana, and I had to drink and brood over that for a long time. And that's right, I met another woman. She's with me. But I got to tell you what happened was, is I went on the drill field, and I became a drill instructor, and I lied and cheated and stole from those recruits, and I'm not proud of that. And I was a maniac, and I fought in the bars, and I was just crazier than hell. And what happened was I couldn't handle it here in the States, and I just had the will to die, but I couldn't kill myself because I was too chicken. And all I thought about was dying, and I thought, I'll just go out a hero. So I volunteered and went back to Vietnam for a second tour. And when I went back over, I got with an infantry unit, and a lot more bad things happened. And I'm not going to go into them tonight. They just got worse, and I was drinking in blackouts, and I was doing a lot of things that carried a lot of shame with me. And what happened as a result of my drinking one day is I was responsible for one of my own men drowning, and I drank over that for a long time. And I learned that I could drop my pack in here with you people, and that I didn't have to look back on the past, that all I've got is right now. You know, all I've got is what's in front of me, and the past is gone. And, you know, I drank over that guilt for a long time. You know, I got wounded again, and I come back home, and you know, I married that woman I met, but I was still a maniac, and I started yelling and screaming at her and putting demands on her. And you know, I drank myself out of the Marine Corps after a short period of time. I spent 11 years, and I drank that career up, and I was starting to get very sick. And you know, if you're macho and tough like I am, there's only one thing you can do. I strapped on a gun and a badge and became a cop in Southern California. And I abused a lot of people on the streets, and I went on duty, and when I went on duty, I couldn't tell that police officer in that police car that was with me that I was terrified. I couldn't tell him how scared I was and how full of fear, and that when I didn't drink, all those thoughts of the things I had done in Vietnam and how I was treating that family and how I treated that first family, and I couldn't tell him my secrets, and my guts was grinding, and I had to drink to go on duty, and I was afraid of the dark, and I was afraid to drive down alleys. And every time I arrested somebody, they scared me so bad I had to beat them, and I'm not proud of that. I'm not proud of that, but that's what alcohol had me doing. And I drank myself out of that job, you see, because I've always got to do things that aren't right. And what happened was is one day my female partner found out that I had got my wife pregnant. You know what my female partner did? This will be another thing that will hurt you. This is a sad part of my story. She shot me. Now, you make out of that what you want to make out of it, because I ain't taking it no further than that. But that ended my police career, and so I did what any self-respecting drunk would do that had a booze habit. I got a real estate license. And if there's anybody here tonight that bought a house in Simi Valley in the 70s, I want to make my amends to you. I can't get the money back to you, but for Christ's sakes, I'm willing to make amends and give you the money if I should ever get it. I got to tell you this, that if you're sitting out there tonight and you think that money, property, and prestige will fix it for you, if you think that if you had a brand new Cadillac sitting in the driveway and you had a house on a quarter acre and you had a little putting green out there and a little swimming pool tucked in the back corner, and your kids were wearing fancy clothes, and your wife's wearing all kind of gold. And you know, when I went out on listing appointments, I wore enough gold chains and diamonds, I looked like a gigolo or a pimp going out there. And I thought that made me look slick, but you know, money, property, and prestige didn't fix it for me, because I was making six figures a year, and I was dying inside. And I was still violent in the bars, and I was still validating my manhood, and I was still crazy. And what happened was, at the age of 36-year-old, I stood there and I looked around. And everything I'd worked all my life to get, all I wanted to do all my life, and I don't know about you, but I was 36-year-old, and the only thing I'd ever wanted to do was be like my father. You know, I love my father. And all I've ever wanted to do was be like him. Just provide a home for the family and have my wife and just all the things that you have. And at the age of 36, I stood there and I looked around, and everything that I'd worked for all my life was gone. That wife and kids had moved with her family up to a trailer in San Jose. That house on that quarter acre was gone. I drank it up. I had a $3,000 a month booze habit. I'd become physically addicted to alcohol, and I didn't know it. and I had a 42-inch waist, and I was turning yellow, and that Cadillac was gone, and that house was gone, and everything was gone, and I didn't know what the hell my problem was, so I switched brands of cigarettes. You know, for a long time, I thought the only denial was the river in Egypt. I didn't know that this was a disease of denial, and I damn near denied it into my grave. And I didn't know those things then. And I didn't know, and I was trying to figure out what was wrong, and I switched cigarettes, and I went to Winston, and they made my gums bleed and my eyes turn yellow. So I went back to Camel, and everything I owned was in a cardboard box in the back seat of a stolen car. And alcohol was not my problem. If you'd have walked up and told me, Frank, your problem's drinking, man. You're drinking everything up. I'd have told you to get out of my face before I break yours. I don't want to hear that crap. Alcohol's the only thing that keeps me sane. And that's how I was. And I started getting sicker and sicker, and I finally had to go to a doctor, and I went to that doctor, and I had a physical, and what that doctor told me was, he says, you're 36-year-old Mr. Jones, and he says, you're dying. And he says, you've got a hole in your throat from the dry heaves, and you've got cirrhosis of the liver and a lung and stomach infection, and all these things that go along with being a chronic alcoholic. And you know what I felt when he told me that? I felt relief. I felt relief, because he told me I was going to die if I didn't quit drinking. And I've wanted to die for a long time. I used to cock my .357 Magnum and stick it in my mouth and not figure out why I couldn't pull the trigger. And when he said, you're going to die, I said, thank you. And I walked out to my car and I picked a beer up off the floorboard of a 1973 stolen Oldsmobile I was driving, which is kind of a class act in itself. I was still promoting American automobiles. And what happened was, as I drove over to Simi Valley from San Jose, and I drank as hard and as fast as I could because I wanted to die, and I couldn't shut my head off because I'd get physically drunk and sicker, but I couldn't shut my head off, and I got crazy, and a woman had taken me into her house, and she was trying to care for me, and my wife and kids were in San Jose, and I felt guilt and remorse and degradation and shame and all those feelings, and I kept drinking and drinking, and I was crapping and urinating blood now, and I was sick, and I got to tell you how God works for me when I don't believe in God. You see, my parents vacationed in a different spot every year in Florida, and I didn't know where they were because I hadn't communicated with them for 4 years. I didn't know where they were because the last time I had seen any of my family and talked to them, I had threatened to kill my brother and burn his house down if he didn't give me some money. And I showed up at his door with a can of gas and an attack dog and a gun. And he gave me some money. And I stole a car and came back to California, and I hadn't seen or heard from them since. But I was sitting on that woman's bed, and I just vomited a pool of blood, and I was drinking 10 high whiskey out of the bottle. And I picked up the telephone, and I dialed a telephone number, and on the other end of that telephone, my dad answered. And he was in Florida someplace. And what I told my dad was, is, I need help. I said, I need a hospital, Dad. And he said, why? And I told him, because I'm an alcoholic, and I'm dying. And I had never said those words in my life. I've never admitted defeat. You see, I've been through the best psychological warfare school the Marine Corps has got. I've been through the best POW schools, and I can stand a lot of pain. I can stand a lot of physical pain. You can whip it on me, and I can handle it. But I was drained emotionally, and I was crazy and suicidal, and I was history. And I knew that, and I cried out for help because I had a moment of clarity. And my father sent me an airline ticket, and I ended up in a hospital back in Indiana. And they lashed me down, and they fed me full of vitamin B and magnesium, and they said I needed 4 or 5 shots. Because my withdrawals were going to be bad because I was addicted the way a heroin addict is to heroin to alcohol. And they called my wife out here in California, and she says she didn't say this, but this is how I perceive it, and I got the mic and she don't. But that doctor in that hospital called her and requested that she come back to Indiana because they thought I'd die before I got through DTs. And what I understand she told that doctor is, let that son of a bitch die. Can you believe that? I had just gave her 9 good years. And I don't know why you're laughing. I didn't die. The committee's not doing this with mirrors. But I got to tell you that today she's my best friend. And we will be married 18 years this year. And she's a good woman. And we've got God, A, and Al-Anon in our house, or we wouldn't have a house or a home. But I didn't die. And I got to tell you what happened as I started going to meetings in there. It's going to be kind of strange to some of you. Southern California don't have this concept yet. But in that hospital where I was, they didn't care about my money. They made me go to AA meetings. Or they discharged me. Can you fathom that? That's phenomenal. And I had to go to AA meetings. And what I heard in those Alcoholics Anonymous meetings time after time after time was, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. If you want to take a drink, go to AA. If you want to take a drink of alcohol, Frank, go to AA meetings. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I heard that, and I sit there and I tried to listen, and you know, I couldn't remember the words to the Lord's Prayer. And I walked with a limp, and I had a speech impediment, I stuttered, and I thought I was crazy, and I couldn't remember my kids' names, or where they were, or my wife, or anything, and I was just nuts. But I kept hearing 90 meetings in 90 days, and I thought, if I want a drink, I'll go to AA. And they said, do that. And I got released out of there after a number of weeks in there. And I walked out two glass doors and I stood out there in that Indiana sun and I started crying. And I was a wimp and I didn't want to be a wimp. And what had happened was I didn't want to take a drink of alcohol. But what happened was all the things I had done when I was a kid, the lying, the cheating, the stealing, the shameful little dirty things I had done come down that sidewalk and started choking me out. And all the things I had done to those two wives and those four kids, and the shame I had put on them and the way I felt come down that sidewalk and started choking me out. And all the little dirty things and the shameful things in Vietnam and when I was a cop come down and started choking me out. And I didn't know what to do because I can't go to AA, I don't want to drink. And suicide became my option. And then if I felt good about me, I thought about killing you. But I just couldn't find out what the answer was. I just stood there and cried. And I got to tell you that if you're an alcoholic the way I am, and I don't know what kind of drunk you are, but you know, I'm a little bit intense. And when I got out, since I've got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have settled down. My sponsor has mellowed me out, and that group I'm in the 12 steps, I am calm, baby. But Alcoholics Anonymous juices me up, and roundups like this juices me up, man. And I tell you, I could be an AA cheerleader tonight because I love this. You're talking about a high, it don't get any better than this. I'm going to tell you that, but I tell you, I was intense and crazy, and I didn't go to AA for 13 months because I haven't had a desire to take a drink for over 8.5 years now. But I got to tell you that if you're like me, what happened to me might happen to you. I didn't go to AA, and I got that wife and kids back, and we moved into a garage in Newhall, and we slept on the floor, and we ate out of a styrofoam chest, and I was still driving a stolen car, and I was still lying and cheating and stealing, and I hadn't changed any of the way I was living, and the only thing I was doing was not drinking. And after 13 months, somebody in the office said, hey, Jones, how you doing? And I thought that was personal. And I didn't think he needed an answer, but I was going to tell him. So I grabbed him by the throat, and I started choking him out. And I told him, how in the hell do you think I feel? And I just flipped out. I squashed all my bananas and went crazy. And I had a nervous breakdown. I just went cuckoo. And these guys pulled me off of it. I'm kicking and screaming and crazy. And this guy walks up, and there was a God in that office that day. A God that I have refamiliarized myself with in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that office that day was a man that was active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful to him. Because he walked up and he gave me a telephone number, and he says, I know what's wrong with you, but he said, I can't help you. I'm afraid of you. And I didn't understand that. They hadn't let go of me yet. They were still holding me down, and I just had small drool coming out of one corner. And I was a little intense and crazy, and for about a week or so, they kept trying to get me to call this man, and I just couldn't get it together, and I cried and beat the floor and wanted to know when the madness was going to stop in my head. And finally, one day, I went down to see this man, and I sit in his office, and I sit there, and I cried. And I couldn't stop crying. And as I sat in that man's office that day, that man explained to me what my problem was. That man told me that I didn't have a problem drinking. And you know he's right. You see, I haven't had a drink. And I've been to a lot of AA meetings, and I haven't seen anybody sit in an AA meeting and have a bourbon and water. And I haven't seen anybody pop a top on a bud. But he said, what I've got is a living problem. And he said, what I suggest you do for your living problem, Slim, is I suggest that you go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he said, what Alcoholics Anonymous will do for you is teach you how to live in a world that you can't cope with emotionally without something chemically in your system, or he says, you're going to go crazy or commit suicide. And I just sit there and cried. And he told me that I had to become committed to Alcoholics Anonymous. That man told me that I had to put Alcoholics Anonymous first in my life. He told me that if I didn't put Alcoholics Anonymous first, that I wouldn't have any life. He says, you've got to put AA before your wife, before your children, and before your job when you get one. And he says, because you're not going to have those things if you don't do that. And he told you, you have to go to those meetings and you have to stick your hand out. And he said, that'll get your sick mind off your sick self. Because he said, if you don't, your ego will kill you. You got an ego problem. And he told me to sit up in the front. And he said, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth and listen. And he told me that I had to get commitments at the meetings. And he told me that I had to go to certain meetings. And he told me that I had to go to those meetings unless there was a death in the family and it was mine. And you see, he told me that I had to start believing in a higher power because he told me that somebody hangs that moon out. And he said, I got to tell you that it's not you. And he said, somebody takes it down in the morning, and he said, it's not you. And he said, whoever that is, you better start praying to him. And he said, I suggest that you get on your knees to do that. He don't want to hear relaxed prayers from somebody laying down. And you know, I listened to that man, and I sit there and I cried. And that man come around from behind his desk that day, and he put his arms around me. And he held me, and he said, you know, you don't have to hurt yourself anymore. He said, why don't you just take your pack off and come along into Alcoholics Anonymous and learn how to live a new life without having to use anything chemical alcohol. And when I looked into that man's eyes that day, you see, I had never trusted or loved anybody like that. When I looked into his eyes, you see, I knew that. I knew that he knew me, and I knew that he was telling me the truth. And I just felt comfortable. And he told me to go to a meeting that night, and I did, and I went to that meeting, and I come in, and I did what he told me to do. And if you knew, these are the things that I did to be comfortable for a long time, because I ain't had a bad day for a long, long time. I can't remember the last gut-wrenching day. But I sat in the front, and I listened, and I stuck my hand out, and I said, hi, I'm Frank. And I asked for a commitment at those meetings, and I got on the cleanup detail. He didn't want me getting some high-profile, low-responsible job. He wanted me doing something down and dirty that I could handle, like swing a mop or a broom or empty trash. And you know, I did that night. And I shook hands with people. And I went home, and before I went in the garage where we were sleeping, I got down on my knees. You see, I don't want my wife to see me on my knees, because that ain't macho. You know, for Christ's sakes, I can be out there throwing up and losing jobs and raising hell, and I don't care who sees me. But as soon as I'm trying to do something to help myself, don't let anybody know I'm in AA. Don't let them know you believe in a God, for Christ's sakes. I'm sorry I said that if you're new. I didn't mean to say God. But you know, I knelt down out there in those stickers in that field we were living in, and I did what that man told me to do. He said, all you got to do is say, thanks for a good day and thanks for my sobriety. And I did that, and I went in the house. And I laid down and I went to sleep, and I got up the next morning. And I went outside that garage, and the sun was up, and I hadn't slept all night in a long time. I stood out there and cried. And I run down to the phone, and I call this man, and I told him, I slept all night. And he said, good, go to a meeting tonight. And I said, why? I feel good. And he says, you drink every night, you got to go to a meeting every night. And if you didn't drink every night, you got to go to a meeting every night. And you know, I started doing those things little by little, and he told me to call him every day, and I didn't know why I had to call that man. I didn't have anything to say to him. I didn't even know him. But something happened. When I went through the day, I'd wait till the last possible minute to call, because I've got fear and I don't want to be rejected and I don't want to sound stupid and I don't want to look bad. But I'd call him, and every time I got through talking to him and I hung that phone up, I felt good. I felt safe, because he was the only person that made me feel safe. And I was full of fear and I was different. You see, you hadn't done the things I had done. You didn't do the things to your family. You didn't do the things overseas. And I felt different. I've been here a long time, and it took me a while to find out that, you know, we've all done the same things. You know, the feeling that you feel when you feel guilty, the same guilt I feel. Guilt is guilt. There's no degree of guilt. If you shoplift a candy bar, me feeling responsible for the man that drowned that day in Vietnam, your guilt is no different than mine. You may just react differently. And I may react different. Your anger is not different than my anger. You can't get madder than I get. I damn near white out. But you can't get madder than me. Anger's anger. And I didn't know that until my sponsor explained that to me, and I sit around and talk to you people, and you told me. You told me how to do this deal. You told me how to do this program. And I wanted it so bad, because you see, when I come into the AA meetings, what I seen was, when I walked through the doors, you didn't say, where you been? What kind of job you got? What kind of job you got? What kind of car you driving? What'd you do overseas? How do you treat your wife and family? You didn't say that to me. When I walked in these doors with you, you stuck your hand out and you said, you're welcome here. Have a cup of coffee. Sit down. Join us. You know, you come up and you put your arms around me and you said the same thing my sponsor said. You said, you don't have to hurt yourself anymore. And what you did is you read to me out of the big book and you told me about the 12 steps. And you did more than just read the 12 steps to me and tell me about them. What you did is you set an example for me to follow. You showed me by your actions. You showed me how you treated each other when you walked in here with your wives and your girlfriends. How you touched each other and how you hugged. And you had that love. And I didn't know how to treat my family when I got here. I didn't know how to treat that wife or those kids. You see, I was full of hate, full of anger, and full of violence. And I watched you. I watched you when you come in the door, and I watched how you treated each other. And I watched you with your children. And I used to call my sponsor, you see, because I got two daughters at home. And when I got here, they was ducking when I walked by. And they weren't touching me and hugging me like they did before I left to come here to you people this weekend. And I went to my sponsor, because my oldest daughter, she'd walk by and she'd say, Dad, I love you, when she was going to bed and I was getting ready to go to a meeting. And you know, I couldn't tell that little girl that I loved her, because I hated myself so bad, because I just despised myself. because she couldn't possibly love me with all the dirty things I had done. But my sponsor says every time you walk by that little girl, he said, I want you to reach out and touch her and tell her you love her, because she don't know that you don't. And he said, in time you will. And you know, I did that. You see, I got here whipped. And you know, I've tried to do everything that I've been told to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, because my thinking got me here. My thinking got me driving a stolen car and living in a garage. And so my thinker's broke. And my sponsor tells me that still today. And I call him for advice still today, but he told me to keep touching her and telling her I love her. And you know, I kept doing that at home. It was hard. I didn't want to tell her because I had no self-worth, but she'd walk by and I'd touch her and she'd say, I love you. And I'd say, I love you too, Trace. And I'd walk on. And she told me how to treat my wife because, you see, I didn't know how to treat my wife. I slept way over on the other side of the floor from her. My sponsor told me when I got home, he said, when you get home, he said, what you have to do is walk in and ask her how she's doing and what kind of day she had at work, because he said, you need to be interested. You're not working. You know what he did? I got to interject this. He just embarrassed the hell out of me. We didn't have any money, and we don't have any money now. But we didn't have a word. We didn't have anything, and he rolled up a whole stack of quarters and taped it up, and he wrote my wife a note that says, here, get your clothes and for you and the children clean, because your husband's too cheap to go out and get a job. And I had to take that home and give it to her. But you know, he told me to reach out and touch my wife and tell her those things. And he said, when she said how her day was, to stand there and listen. And I used to wiggle my toes in my shoes because I wasn't interested in her. I was interested in me. Me, 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 the mighty I am. That's me. I'm me. I'm interested in me. Self. I. You see, I wasn't interested in that woman. But he told me I had to stand there and listen, and I knew he wasn't watching me. At least I thought he wasn't. I found out since I've been sober, he does watch me. He is everywhere. And I stood there and I listened, and I wiggled my toes in my shoes trying to simulate interest, and I'd almost doze off, but I'd listen. And you know, by taking those actions, I became interested in what she's doing. I became interested in her job and how she's doing at work and how she feels about things. Because you see, I watched you with your wives long enough, and she's been in Al-Anon long enough, and I've been in AA long enough to find out she is an individual. She is a person that has a right to have an opinion, and I don't have to shove mine down her throat. She has the right to dress and act the way she wants to dress and act. She has the right to do the things that she does. And I didn't know that until I got here with you. You see, I got a little girl at home, too, that she's 12 now. And when I got sober, she was about 3 years old. And that little girl had never told me she loved me, and she had never hugged me. And one day I was getting ready, and we had moved out of that garage because I had to get a job to become self-supporting. I couldn't lie, cheat, and steal, borrow from my parents or anything, so he made me get a job, and I got a job as a security guard. And that was demeaning to me. That was beneath my station and my ego. Because, you see, I've been a drill instructor and a Marine, and I'm a veteran, for Christ's sakes, and I've been a cop. But he says, you take the first person that'll handle you and be grateful that you got hired at all, and I did that. And I worked graveyard shift, and I used to go to work after the meetings. And that first check I got for $140 for 2 weeks' work, I cried, and I called him and asked him, how do I spend it? What do I do with it? Because, you see, I don't know how to do nothing. And he told me. But, you see, I got a little girl at home that hadn't told me she loved me or hugged me, and I had worked long enough now, and we had moved out of that garage into a little house there with real furniture that some people had given us and stuff. And I was getting ready for a meeting, and I had been telling her I loved her and stuff and trying to be a kind, loving father instead of an angry, hateful man. And she come running by me this night. I was going to a meeting. She stopped, and she looked at me. She was 6 years old now, and I'd been around AA over 3 years. And she stopped, and she looked at me, and she got up in my lap, and she put her arms around me, and she gave me a kiss, and she said, I love you. And, you know, she was 6 years old, and she had never done that until that night. And, you know, the feeling I got from that, you can't get anywhere but in rooms like this. And, you know, she's done it a lot since then. She's become my all-time favorite 12-year-old. She even took golf lessons to be with me. I just can't believe it, what you've done for me. You see, let me tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't given me the suit that I'm wearing tonight. You know, I had to get a job and become self-supporting, and I have a problem in the work area, and I try. But I try to stay employed because my self-worth goes to hell when I'm not, and then it distorts my perception, and then I start feeling bad about me, and if I feel bad about me, I got to take it out on my family and other people. And so I try to stay employed, but I had to get a job, and I get my clothes either at Kmart or Mervyn's or wherever I buy my clothes. AA don't issue those. You got to get a job, folks, if you're going to get clothes. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't give me the car that I'm driving. You see, I had to pay for that, and I had to make payments, and I had to register it and get insurance, or I couldn't drive it. I had to become an adult. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't get me my job. I got to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a set of tools in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Has given me a set of tools that I can go out with and build myself a new life if I choose to work all 12 of those steps in my daily life. Alcoholics Anonymous has provided me those tools. All the tools that I need. It's provided me tools on how to treat you. It's provided me tools on how to treat my wife and my children. It's provided me tools on how I can write out a fourth step and get rid of all my garbage and put it behind me when I read my fifth step. And doing it one time isn't the key to it, I've learned. I have to do when things start bearing down on me and I start getting angry and crazy and I get out of sorts and I look at you and you look a little crappy to me. I got to start writing on some things and I may have some problems. And I've been around AA and I've been around the good examples in this program that are in this room tonight long enough to know that I've got to take that to my sponsor, that I can't hide it. I can't hide things anymore from you. I've got to open myself up and let you know, and I've got to write that down, and I take it to my sponsor, and he either puts it in his pocket or he reads it, and he says, let me worry about it, kid, go on and do what's in front of you. And you know, I try to do that. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to do that with these tools. It's allowed me to get down on my knees and try to turn my will and my life over to care of God as I understand God. You see, it's my own concept of God. It's not some God that'll punish me, not some God that's judging me whether I'm good or bad. It's a God that loves me and wants only the best for me, and he'll put things in front of me. I don't have to look for anything anymore. Everything's provided to me if I'll just turn my eyes out from myself long enough to see it. And if I open my ears long enough to talk to you and listen to you and have you provide for me. You see, you nourish me with the knowledge you give me. You nourish me with the love and emotions and the feelings that you give me. Because I feel them in rooms like this, and I feel them at my home group. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous is first in my life, and those 12 steps have done that for me. It allows me to sit down and eat a meal, and I don't have to throw it up. It allows me to go home at night and sleep with my wife, and I don't have to validate myself with another woman since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a relief. That's comfortable for me. My wife is enough. Now, there's a lot of lovely ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous. I look at you, and my sponsor tells me, he says, you can think anything you want. You just can't act on it. There's a lot of foxes here, and I just love all of you. But you're dignified ladies that are working a program, and you're doing it. And what I do is today is I respect you. I respect you, and I love you, because you're my AA sister. And I learned that here from you people. You see, I learned how to treat women here. And I just think that's just a wonderful thing that I've learned. I've learned how to treat my children. I have a relationship today with my mother and my father. A month ago, I got to go back. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't just give you good things and it's all fun and roundups and conventions and AA meetings and love and all these things. You know, there's some pain in Alcoholics Anonymous because outside these rooms, real life is going on. And I couldn't deal with real life. But what's happened here is I've learned to take this meeting home with me, and I've learned to take my home group and my sponsor's advice and try to live in that mainstream. And there's some painful things in AA, and I went home a month ago. You see, my father's dying, and he's got Alzheimer's, and he has a blood clot on the brain, and he had a stroke last week. And you know, I call my sponsor, and I talk to Johnny, and I talk to Clance, and I talk to the people here, and I said, what do I do when I go home? How do I act? And they said, why don't you suit up and show up when you get there? You're only at the Wednesday night meeting tonight. Why don't you stay in the now? And you know, that's a hell of a concept. I didn't know that. Because you see, I want to project ahead, and I was already in pain and already full of fear and full of sadness and self-pity and sympathy. And the key is stay in the now. But you see, I got to go home, and I got to be with him. And I got to be an example for my mother and my father, and I got to love him and hug him. And I told him I loved him, and he didn't know who I was. Till after I left, Mom called and said it was good having Frank home. You can't get there where I was. You can't do it. And I love my mom, and I got to see my oldest daughter get married, and she had disowned me. And I got to stand there at her wedding and be with her and be an example, and she hugged me and said, I'm proud of you, Dad. And you know, you can't get that out of a bottle. You can't get that out of a bottle. Those feelings that I had, and I got to leave with dignity, and I kissed my mom, and I hugged my dad, and I came back to you. And you told me it'll be all right. And I have friends in the program that have gone through similar things, and they give me strength, and they give me hope. And I nourish off of you all these feelings that I can't deal with. I have a son, and I heard Yvonne today talk about her daughter. I got a son that's in prison. You know, he's 22 years old. He shot a guy. He dealt dope. He's a drug addict. He's alcoholic. The hardest thing I've had to do in sobriety is my sponsor said, you have to throw him out of your house. You can't deal drugs in my house. He was 15. And I packed up everything that kid owned and I put it out. He's never lived in my house since that day. But I come to you and I talk to you about it and I talk to my sponsor about it and you gave me the strength. You gave me the spirituality into my heart that I could carry that and I was okay with it. And he got in a lot of trouble and he's in a lot of trouble. And what you told me when I told you about it is it said, stay here in AA with us and be an example for him when he gets out. And you know I've been an example for him and I didn't go to jail and see him and I didn't go to his trial. You see, I didn't help put him there. And before Christmas, he called me and he asked me if I'd come and see him. He'd been sober about a year. And I went down there to see him and I hugged him and I embarrassed him because he's macho. But you know, he hugged me back. And I told him, I'll be here for you when you get out if I keep doing the actions I'm doing here with you people. And he hugged me and you know, he's sober today. He called me before I came here to the roundup. And you know, I love my son and I'm proud of him. You see, I can't judge him. Look at where I was at the age of 19. Who am I to judge my son? I can't judge my son. I need to be a father to my son. I need to give him what you've given me here, unconditional love. That's what I have to pass on. I've lost jobs in sobriety. I lost a business, and we lost all our money. And I'm not back on my feet yet because I have a problem in the work area. And financially, it's tough, but we're making it, and we have a good life together. We've got God, AA, and Al-Anon in our house, and we couldn't have a house or a home without it. My wife goes to a lot of meetings, and she's active in Al-Anon. And she has a good program, and it's dynamite. It's a loving program. And she allows me to do AA a lot. This is the first weekend in 4 years that we've had a full weekend together. And she doesn't get on my back about it. She supports me. And I support her in her program. You know, I have a little more time than she does on my hands. So I help her with her Al-Anon program. I'm just a giver. You know, she did an inventory and I told her, don't worry about it. I'll give your sponsor the copy I did. But you know, we've got a God AA and Al-Anon home today. And I'm grateful for that because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what you people have given me. You've nourished me back to health. You've done what I've always wanted to do. And you've done it for me. You've taken me and you've put me right back in the center of my family. You've added a little dignity and respect to my life. You've reintroduced me to a God that I knew all along. And Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no better place. If you're a drunk, if you're a drunk with problems when you quit drinking and you can't cope with life, if you're a drunk that has a problem dealing with people, if you have a problem with a higher power, if you have anything like I've said tonight about the emotions that I'm dealing with, you don't have to hurt yourself anymore. You don't have to hurt yourself because Alcoholics Anonymous is the only way to go. Alcoholics Anonymous will take you and restore you to sanity. Alcoholics Anonymous will allow you to live a comfortable, peaceful, and joyous life like we're doing here in this convention because it doesn't get better than this. This is absolutely phenomenal. I have been pumped up and sky high since I got here. And it's just phenomenal, the feelings. And I watch the people and I watch them smile and I watch you with your children and I just get filled up here. I just get filled up with peace and joy and happiness. And it just doesn't get any better than this, folks. But the things I've said tonight, you don't have to listen to. Because what I've said tonight will mean absolutely nothing to you. They only mean something to me. What they mean to me is it reminds me of what I used to be like. It reminds me of the anger and the hateful person that had no regard for human life. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and my God that got me here to you. And since I've been here with you, it's allowed me to do some things with my life as a result of watching you and your example. And that's for me to remember and for me to always keep up front in my face is what you've done for me and what my life is like today because I'm peaceful and I'm happy and I'm free most of the time. The only thing I think that if I was new tonight or I had a newcomer baby or if you're out there and you're old and you're feeling a little used, you need to remember something that you probably didn't even pay any attention to. It didn't even just pass right over you. But it's the most important thing in this book for me. And I try to remember it on a daily basis. And I try to remember it when I get down on my knees and I thank my God for being here with you. And that's the first line of chapter 5 that Gene read tonight. And that first line of chapter 5 says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Thank you.